Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged to welcome a very tall leader from the world of academia, from Chicago, USA, Professor Varghese Mathai, PhD. Varghese, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashutosh.
Professor Mathai is a professor of English at Judson University in Illinois. He's a Fulbright Scholar and the Benjamin P. Brown Chair of Communications at Judson University. He teaches British poetry and literature of spirituality. His publications include The Malabar Mandate, A Life of Walbrecht Nagel, The Village Maestro and 100 Other Stories, and Mahakavi K.V. Simon, The Milton of the East. So, Varghese, let me start with my first question to you. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to pursue a career in British poetry and literature of spirituality?
Well, the answer to me was very simple. It seemed as though I was meant to have a career in the study of languages. Mm-hmm. Languages came very easy to me. There were certain other things that were not that easy. I had to make a considerable effort to be comfortable with them. But I always enjoyed language, various languages, and English, of course, was my favorite. I have spent most of my time reading and studying and then teaching English. That has become a career. I wasn't actually looking for a career in English or as a teacher. My desire was to be a businessman. Okay. But in retrospect, I consider, I now see that I didn't have that business personality also, mm-hmm. although I had certain things that could have been applied successfully to business, but that's a different matter.
Yeah.
So it is natural affection I felt for language, mm-hmm. and anything well said and anything that is poetic, anything that had deeper truths embedded in it. Those were things I went after, and if there something struck me, I would just go back and read it and go deeper into it, and then one book I'll jump into another book, and sometimes I have 6-7 books open on my desk at the same time, mm-hmm. and I'll be jumping from one to the other. So the world of letters simply fascinates me, even now. The same kind of freshness that I had as a little child.
Fascinating. And why the focus on British poetry? I mean, there's so much poetry in the US and so many other parts of the world.
Well, British simply has to be taken as a synonym for English because, you know, it is not really English alone, British alone that I read, but it's just... In the catalog description of college courses, you have most of these English writings originating in English, but there are a lot of authors who are English authors themselves who might not be considered strictly English. For instance, W. H. Auden, T. S. Eliot, our own Rudyard Kipling. E.M. Forster, all of these people, they are global people. So England is simply a launching place, that little island, but they expand also into a literary empire. So it's impossible to study any kind of poetry without studying. If the writings are in English, then we have to go to England. But now the population is moving in massive numbers from different parts of the world. Languages are also moving with them, and leading the language train is English still. And I remember about 3 or 4 decades ago, there was a fear that English was going to disappear because there are national movements taking place and
Right.
English will gradually fade away. Of course, any language will fade away as Greek did or Latin did
Yeah.
or Sanskrit did. So language, each language has its own lifetime, has its own lifetime. But it seems English is only grounding itself deeper and wider. So it's a safe investment of, you
Fascinating.
know,
Fascinating. And what do you think is the significance of spirituality in literature?
Oh, wonderful. I mean, literature has to be, primarily literature is a criticism of life. Life is a subject matter of it. And there are various forms of life, biological life and mechanical life and, you know, but spirituality is a form of, it's the highest form of intelligence. There is no literacy without spirituality, because as you are very familiar with the Indian wisdom, you know, the literature is akshara. There is no chaya to it. I mean, it doesn't wear off. It is the imperishable, the arch, as Gerard Manley Hopkins says, the arch original syllable. That is God himself, you know. It is from that syllable that the rest of all languages, all words, and all, you know, everything comes. And William Blake said, imagination is the gift of the divine. And that comes from, you know, the divine source, who it is impossible to bypass the reality of the higher truths, the cosmic power that has been that's being radiated constantly without any mitigation at all the time, stays the same, you know, yesterday, today, and forever the same.
What a great
So,
response. What a great response. Thank you. My next question is that, you know, what in your view is the broader impact of studying English poetry and spiritual literature on society?
Well, the spiritual reality is not going to go away. The quality of life that we experience depends on the quality of spiritual understanding that we have. And that understanding is transmitted through our conduct, through our ethic, through our thinking. You know, in societies that are not spiritually toned, we would find it very risky. You know, we cannot live there, because there cannot be law and order in an unspiritual society. Law itself is enforced love, you know. In one of my, this is a storybook that you mentioned earlier, you know, Village Maestro and 100 other stories. And I have a parable in it that makes a reference to Princess Diana, who died in that, you know, terrible accident. Now, what is not widely discussed is that there's this Samaritan, Good Samaritan law in France, and as it, you know, as there is in other countries too, that if you see somebody in peril, you have to stop and provide possible attention, and that is a proper civic thing to do.
Right.
That is also the spiritual thing to do. But if somebody does not do that, that society breaks down. But the other principle in that fact is that, give me a second. The other principle is, we have to love people, and people are not going to show spontaneous affection to others. A lot of people are not. So in such cases, we have to enforce it, but it's the enforcement of love. You know, when you say you should not kill someone else, the motivation is love and respect for that, for people, you know, for that we naturally have.
Right.
And that love has to be safeguarded. And so if you interpret law correctly, you will see that every law is meant for human well-being, and that well-being is in the desire for well-being is inspired by love. And so you go through the great chain of being, you can see the levels of love displayed by the Spirit of God that all humans can access without paying a single penny.
Very well said.
It's the greatest gift with no cost to it, on our side.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, you are the expert when you look at spirit representation of spirituality in contemporary literature as compared to classical works. Do you see any differences?
The need for spirituality and spiritual behavior, spiritual instincts, those do not go away from the human, from the human composition. It is very much there. We are built, you know, we are wired to seek and to respond to the truth of love, the impulses of love, and so on. Now, the ancient expression of spirituality was sometimes more formalized and less divided. It was widely understood. In the beginning, there was a word, and the word was God, and word was with God. And you know, so there is no divisive understanding in it. You go to the original, the arch original spirit of God. Now, in the modern approach that we're witnessing, there is a lot of splintering of that view. You know, there are different ways of thinking, and there's sort of customizing spirituality according to a person's own instincts. There is enough justification for why I think the way I think, and so on. Whereas the search should be, the understanding is far more, far plainer than people think it is. If we just look around, so as soon as a child is born, there is a cry, but immediately along with the cry, there is a reaching for the breast of the mother. Now, that mother's breast milk is ready as soon as a child arrives,
correct,
but not 30 minutes earlier.
Absolutely.
And so that means there is a very thoughtful provision by divine affection already embedded in creation. Even the little lamb or little cow, you know, the calf is already taken care of. Is already taken care of. And what happens as a tragedy to life is that people try to deny it to the needy and to the deserving. You know, our gifts are waiting there with our name on them, so to speak.
Very interesting. And therefore, your response encourages me to ask you a slightly different question. That, you know, poetry is there in multiple languages. Which also is a function of multiple cultures and multiple faiths. How do English poetry and spirituality intersect with other global literary traditions?
Again, it is simply a switch of words, because human hunger, for example, is the same everywhere. You know, our response to heat or cold is the same everywhere.
Right.
Our need for fulfillment, our need for water when we thirst, our need for comfort when we are weary, all these things are universal. These things don't change at all. So there's an American poet by name Edward Taylor, who lived in the 17th century. He just looks at the world and he says, who in this bowling alley bowled the sun? You know, how does the sun appear in the horizon with such regularity? He thinks it's like somebody has been bowling, you know, the what is it, the ball. Now, who is this bowling alley ball? The sun. That question is naturally going to be there to every observer. And it is impossible to ignore the cycle of seasons, the symmetry of human organs, or the rhythm of the change of seasons, the law of seed time and harvest, casting your bread upon the waters and it returning to you after many days. All of these, you know, these are to the keen observer, these are all, as Shakespeare says, sermons in trees. You know, you can, every branch, every twig holds a sermon. Even the fading leaf, as it falls, is preaching aloud without an audible word. And so it appears in all languages, whether it is Hindi or Chinese or, you know, Syriac. Or, and we'll also see when we study the history of any language or any culture, it goes back to a to a source book, a compendium of its the culture's wisdom collected in a book. And so they are, as Augustus Caesar was, you know, keen on the book of Virgil, you know, and that was a greater treasure than all the other wealth accumulated. So there is a passion in every culture to go back, as you all also said earlier, in the Indian classics, for example, even people who have not read the Mahabharata or the Ramayana or Bhagavad Gita, or, you know, any number of other great works, they have a certain pride in it, and they know that the great formative influence of even their language, the manner of their speech, and their public conduct, all of these come from the great classics, you know, the imperishable works.
Fascinating, fascinating. I have two more questions, and then I want one question on Mahakavi K.V. Simon.
Okay, sure.
How important is understanding the historical context when studying poetry and literature?
Actually, it overlaps with what I already said, because we are deriving wisdom from that the main pool, the prime fountain. In the Book of Kings in the Old Testament, the Jewish people have the story of of two great prophets, Elijah and Elisha. And when Elisha succeeds Elijah, they come to him, the people run to him and say, "Master, we have a great problem in the city of Jericho. The city is so beautiful, it is picturesque. Unfortunately, the water that comes into the city is so destructive. It causes, it causes abortions, you know, and that in itself is sufficient reason for the healing of the waters." And so the prophet brings a certain measure of salt and puts that in the water, and the whole city is healed. Now, where, I mean, they are getting pure water, you know, that kind of healing of the waters at the head start and the head springs is what the determines the health of a people or a community. And so would you repeat your statement one more time, that question?
No, so I was asking you about the historical context.
Yeah.
How important is it to understand the historical context?
Yeah. So everything, you know, as Thoreau said, you know, Thoreau said, everyone listens to a particular drumbeat. You know, we, in every individual culture, we are listening to its own drumbeat. And we are following the instincts that we have observed will be practical, beneficial, and successful. Now, the poetry that we read comes from a number of inspirational sources. Sometimes it is a victory in war. Sometimes it is a compassion that is demonstrated by a great saint. Sometimes it is a teaching of a great guru. And sometimes it is a wonder of nature. But everything has its own context. But certain things, when they become, we cannot always understand things easily, that T.S. Eliot would say. For that, you will definitely need a historical background, a contextual background, an interpretive background, and so on. And once you get that, you get mysteries unlocked, and then you have this euphoric experience of discovery. And so we have to say we study people like Thomas More or St. Augustine or Chrysostom or Jerome or Tertullian or Origen, all these people. These are phenomenal people. Now, these people lived, 1,500, 1,600 years ago, many of them. And there is a reason we go back to them, because, in the normal world, if someone dies, after a week's time, nobody talks about that person, because life gets all on top of us, and on top of this, new waves come. But then, if there is a reason for us to go back to Euclid or Archimedes or, Erasmus or people like that, going back centuries, there has to be a reason. And that reason is explained by the historical context only. Without the context, we will not understand. This is true of biblical prophecies, for example. There are so many prophecies that were made about individuals, places, and even, of course, definitely about Christ himself. But you have to go to the expert sources where the commentaries are provided for the context. So when we are studying good poetry with good commentary, we have a more complementary experience, other than just reading a random text, which is subject to all kind of misperceptions.
Amazing. And I'm sure our viewers and listeners will appreciate how important it is to understand the historical context when you are trying to understand poetry and literature, and literature spirituality. Is my last question to you, and I want to come to your book, Mahakavi K.V. Simon, Milton of the East. If you have the book with you, do show us the book. There we are. Tell us a little bit about the poet and what has gone into writing this book.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful. Be happy to. Now, this book, I am so fascinated. I felt compelled to write about this man, no matter what, because, first of all, K.V. Simon is a South Indian poet. He died in 1944. His lifetime is 1883 to 1944. He lived in a village of Kerala that didn't have electricity, a paved road, a library, or any of the modern conveniences of life. Was born in a middle class agrarian kind of family. Now, but he was such a precocious child, the last among 10 children. And didn't need to be persuaded to study. He was just so passionately in love with knowledge, and he explored everything that was available in the form of knowledge that came to him. Now, he had this remarkable ability. He started writing poetry at the age of six. And he would memorize long passages that run the full length, like Pope's Alexander Pope's Dunciad or The Rape of the Lock, or some of these longer poems. And reading it once, he would have it completely etched in his memory. There is no need for him to read a thing a second time. He began to study languages. He mastered 12 languages, definitely had good practical knowledge, practical demonstrated skill in Hebrew, Latin, Aramaic, Sanskrit, English, and all of the Indian languages.
Amazing.
And he wrote verse in many of them, and he wrote he translated from one language to another, and then he started composing hymns. He belonged to a Christian community called Syrian Christian. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm aware.
Yeah, you know, India is generally perceived to be totally one religion country, which, as you know, is not the case.
Correct. Absolutely.
And in Kerala, Apostle Thomas, a disciple of India, came in AD 52 and converted the upper class.
In fact, I have often said to people that India is the only country in the world where every single religion of the world is present.
Present, yes, indeed.
Everything.
And there is this maxim that says Christianity in India is as old as Christianity itself.
Correct.
And the same thing could be said about the Islamic faith.
Absolutely.
Islamic faith also arrived.
Islamic faith, Zoroastrianism, they've all been here for a very, very long time.
Yeah. And so religion has never been a point of objection or resistance at all. They welcomed it. And so the people who followed Apostle Thomas became known as Thomas Christians, St. Thomas Christians, or Syrian Christians because they used the language of Syriac.
Correct.
And Simon was born as a Syrian Christian in the Syrian community. But unfortunately, they also had their own era of dark ages, just as the European church had its own dark ages. And Simon was the person to examine and to question the practices of an unenlightened church.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, if you're following, calling yourself people of God, people of the church, and people of Christ, you need to know what Christ said. And so he called them into the study of the scriptures, and he became the exemplar of an excellent teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He is most outstanding commentator of the scriptures.
Amazing.
He wrote Bhakti poetry. He wrote 300 hymns, which are available. A lot of them, at least 50 of them, you can easily see in a single search on YouTube or so. And all of them were written in classical meters, in raga, in Carnatic ragas, and so on. Simon wrote over 30 books. He had a public life where every day he would be speaking to a few hundreds to multiple thousands of people. And his home was turned into, his home was Gurukula. People would come and live there and study, people of all ages, even children. And because there were no public schools available at that time.
He
was teaching all them, not a penny accepted from anybody. And he became the founder of a movement that did not like war. It's called the Brethren Church. You know, the Brethren, it's a small denomination, but it's very, very powerful. You could say that he is one of the founding leaders of the Brethren movement in India. When I read his hymns, I felt, my goodness, this man should not be forgotten, buried in a country grave of Kerala. So I said this would be my humble attempt
to
introduce the man to the wider world. There is so much more
but
the book,
I agree.
The book starts with the question, who is Simon? And I give a 100-page a description of the biography, 100-page biography of Simon. And then I've also taken 1,500 lines of Simon's epic, a Mahakavya. You know, somebody who writes a Mahakavya is a Mahakavi. Maybe I'm running out of time here already, but
maybe I'll schedule another conversation only on Mahakavi.
Yeah, well, probably we should. I'm sorry.
That's absolutely okay. But I do want to say, Professor Mathai, thank you so much for speaking to me. I mean, I've always been fascinated with literature and language,
sure.
and I've learned many new things from you about English poetry and spirituality today. Thank you for speaking to me about so many different aspects of how not only English literature, but spirituality and history are all interlinked, not just English, but in multiple cultures and multiple languages as well. Thank you also.
Even Simon, we would not understand without the historical background.
Correct. Thank you also for speaking to me about Mahakavi K.V. Simon. I will schedule maybe a full podcast with you on K.V. Simon, but I will need to do a little more reading about him before I can have an intelligent conversation with you.
All right.
Thank you again for speaking to me, and good luck.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ashutosh.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.